Alaska News. Last night's war communique announced the Japanese occupation of Nanching, N-A-N-C-H-E-N-G, 150 kilometers southeast of Nanchang, N-A-N-C-H-A-N-G, in Jiangxi province. At the same time, it was announced that the Chinese had retaken Suwen, T-S-U-N-G-J-E-N, 90 kilometers south of Nanchang. On the Kuangtung front, Chinese forces attacked the invaders near Sunghua, T-S-U-N-G-H-U-A, last Thursday, inflicting considerable casualties, and at the same time beat back a Japanese thrust from Yuantan, Y-U-A-N-T-A-N. In North China, in southern Shanxi, S-H-A-N-S-I, province, the Japanese suffered another defeat when they attempted to drive from their base south of Fencheng, F-E-N-C-H-E-N-G. 1,000 Japanese soldiers, equipped with 4 mountain guns, 6 tanks, and 2 armored cars, were ambushed by the Chinese and forced into a pell-mell retreat. The China Times today attached considerable importance to the battle going on in the Aleutian Islands. Expressed the belief that this latest Japanese move, launched after the losses in the Coral Sea and Midway engagement, aims to wipe out the American Navy in the Northern Pacific and thus endanger the Chinese Army and the Soviet Army. The move may be regarded as an attempt to attack America proper and encircle the USSR at the same time. If the enemy can secure a base in the Alaska areas, the position of the United Nations will be greatly jeopardized, with Canada, the United States, the Hawaiian Islands, and the USSR's far eastern position under the constant pressure and threat of the invaders. The position of Australia would also be greatly endangered if the enemy should choose to strike south at the same time. On the other hand, if the democratic powers can bestow death blows on the enemies in the Alaskan regions and pursue them right to the heart of Japan, their collapse will be in sight. The paper points out an interesting parallel in the present Japanese attack in the North Pacific to that of their treacherous attacks on Pearl Harbor and Australia. Japan started a peace offensive on the United States before assaulting Alaska, thus attempting to blind the eyes and ears of the Americans to her real intentions. This is similar to Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, while the U.S.-Japanese peace talks were still going on in Washington. It is further paralleled by Japan's onslaught on Australia while pretending to attack India. The best way to overcome this bandit thief-like tactics of the enemy is not to trust anything the Japanese may say and to continue the Allied active offensive. The Chinese view with equal concern the situation in Alaska and the Chekiang-Jiangxi battle, the China Times declared. China is exerting her best to relieve the pressure on the Allies. From the Alaska battle, the United Nations can learn more fully and deeply the true meaning of the Allies' oneness of purpose, spirit of offensive action, and bond of alliance and allegiance. Yesterday morning, the people of Chongqing awoke to find the city colorfully bedecked with the flags of China and her 27 LLs in the cause of the United Nations. Activities in celebration of United Nations Day began with a mass meeting attended by several thousand at the New Life Model Center in the heart of China's wartime capital. Throughout the day, the celebrations continued, featured by a number of broadcasts by prominent citizens of China and by foreign diplomats. To lend a note of gaiety to the day's activities, athletic contests were held in Chongqing, in football, volleyball, and baseball games,
and swimming matches.
In the afternoon, a tea
bottle,
attended by Generalissimo and Madame Jane Fairchet,
was given
for foreign guests at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Bringing the day's festivities to a close, a dinner for some 400 guests
was given at the Jialing,
C-H-I-A-L-I-N-G, house
by the cultural associations of Chongqing,
following which broadcasts were made by a number of foreign diplomats. A musical program was also provided by the Central Training Institute,
and films were flashed on a screen showing the United Nations at war. In addressing a message to the United Nations, President Lin Sen said, "On this day, I wish to send a message of goodwill to the nations associated with China in this war. In the minds of the Chinese people, the requirements of an enduring peace are twofold. First, the United Nations should disarm all the oppressing states. Second, they should create an effective and permanent system for collective security." The dinner, featuring radio messages by diplomatic representatives of the United Nations, in which confidence and optimism formed the keynote, climaxed yesterday's celebrations in Chongqing. 400 people, including high Chinese officials, members of the diplomatic missions of the United Nations, members of the various communities of the United Nations, representatives of international cultural relations organizations in the wartime capital, and members of the British, American, and Dutch military missions jammed the main dining hall of Jialing House to bear testimony to the spirit of solidarity and collaboration that prevails among the 28 United Nations now fighting aggression. The venue of the meeting was gaily decorated by the flags of the Allied nations with catchy slogans. A huge V surrounded by the Allied flags with the Chinese characters celebrated United Nations victory was hung above the platform. Band music was provided, a well-arranged musical program was given, and motion pictures entitled United Nations at War rounded out the evening's program. In his opening remarks as toastmaster of the evening, General Wu Te-Cheng emphasized the importance of the occasion, after which he called upon Dr. H.H. Kung to address the gathering. On behalf of the Chinese government and people, Dr. Kung welcomed the representatives of the Allied nations and military missions and thanked the governments and peoples of the friendly powers for their moral and material assistance in the past. He reiterated China's confidence in the ultimate victory of the United Nations. However, he reminded the United Nations that they must not only win the war, but also the peace. At 8:30 p.m. Chongqing time, a special radio program arranged for the evening was begun. The first speaker was General Wu Te-Cheng, who began the program with the following remarks. Tonight, under the auspices of the international cultural organizations in Chongqing, we celebrate United Nations Day in China. There are here the representatives of 9 of the United Nations who will send you greetings from China's wartime capital. We gladly dedicate this day as a special tribute to that gallant company of nations which have solemnly pledged themselves to defend and preserve civilization for mankind. China is proud to include herself among that distinguished company. There is no fitter occasion than this to reassert that China will do her utmost to bring about the defeat of the Axis powers. At one time, things looked very bleak for China. At one time, we fought alone, yet we continued successfully to resist. Now that we are one of a brotherhood of United Nations, all pledged to the one purpose, we look forward with the utmost confidence to the defeat of our enemies. Long live the United Nations. General Wu was followed by the Soviet ambassador, Mr. Alexander S. Kanyushkin. Mr. Anishkin declared, "On this happy occasion, in celebration of United Nations Day, I take the opportunity to state that my country, signatories to the declaration of the 26 countries made in Washington on January 1st of this year, is doing our utmost to smash the worst enemy of mankind, Hitlerite Germany. Just about a year ago, fascist Germany, aiming at enslavement, at enslaving my country and my people, launched without reason the most treacherous attack upon the freedom and peace-loving peoples of the Soviet Union. For just about a year now, the Soviet peoples have been carrying arms on the battlefields. This holy and gigantic struggle for the purpose of upholding democracy and civilization, as well as their right to live a free life. For just about a year now, the Soviet Union has been waging the war for the annihilation of the most wicked forces ever assembled under the name of Hitlerism, which really represents nothing more than a bunch of criminals, robbers, and murderers. For just about a year now, the peoples of the Soviet Union have been waging this war under conditions of growing international solidarity among all the anti-aggression democracies of the world. Today, it is particularly fitting for me to quote to you here the order of the day issued by Mr. Stalin on May 1st of this year. Mr. Stalin said in that order, as regards the international connections of our motherland, they have recently grown and gained strength as never before. This friendship and alliance have been further strengthened by the treaty recently concluded between Great Britain and the Soviet Union and signed in Washington by Mr. Eden and Mr. Molotov, and by the latter's visit to Washington. As a result of this visit, I am happy to inform you another agreement was signed on June 11th between the United States of America and my country on the important matter of mutual aid constituting war against aggression. Although our enemy is still a strong foe, I am sure that the task put by Mr. Stalin to the entire Red Army, that is, to achieve that the year 1942 should become the year of the final debacle of the German fascist troops and the liberation of Soviet soil from the Hitlerite scoundrels, shall be carried out. Together with her allies and friends, the Soviet Union will be celebrating the final victory over the enemy. The next speaker was the American ambassador, Mr. Clarence E. Gross, who presented the following message. I extend the greetings of the United States of America on this occasion of the celebration of United Nations Day. By the pact at Washington, the 27 United Nations have joined as partners in the titanic struggle being waged against the savage and brutal forces of conquest and tyranny. Each of these United Nations has pledged to employ its full resources, military and economic, against the enemies with which it is at war. Each of them has pledged to cooperate with its partners and not to make a separate armistice or peace. And each has pledged to a peace which will afford to our nation the means of dwelling in safety within their own boundaries and which will afford assurances that all men in all lands may live out their lives in freedom. The Declaration of the United Nations speaks not of power for territory or plunder or power. It speaks of the rights of man, the rights of freedom of thought, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. For America, as a partner of the United Nations, I repeat to you as appropriate to this occasion the words of the President of the United States, our cause is right, our goal is worthy, our strength is great and good. Sir Horace Seymour, the British ambassador, then said, on behalf of the British community in Chungking, I would like to express the gratitude we all feel at being privileged to share in the celebration of United Nations Day. The name of Chungking has come to stand throughout the free world as a symbol of the will to be free. a confirmed resolve that the long 5-year struggle shall end in victory. No place, surely, could be better suited from this for celebrating that union of heart and will which inspires the United Nations. The great river on whose banks this city stands is at this season daily and rapidly increasing in strength and volume. The mighty flow of the Yangtze may perhaps serve as a sign of the increasing power, the growing confidence and determination of the United Nations. We do not doubt that there are many trials and dangers still to be endured. We know that our liberties can only be secured by hard fighting and by the courage, hard work, and high resolve not only of the fighting men, but of the men and women behind the lines. We have long had the proofs that this courage, this resolution, is forthcoming in full measure, and we look forward to that day, near or far, when the United Nations, their present task accomplished, will cooperate in founding that new world order which we all desire. Sir Frederick Eggleston, the Australian minister, then gave the following message. This meeting of the United Nations in Chungking is held at what I believe is a turning point in the war. It affords us an opportunity of further pledging our faith in one another, our mutual loyalty to the one great cause, and the determination of each to do his utmost to ensure victory. This determination must be based on a resolve to rid ourselves of those two great drags on the machinery of war, complacency and inaction. Steadfast patience is a great thing, but when steadfastness becomes complacency and patience becomes inaction, we are in greater danger of defeat than when the enemy is battering at our gates. Patriotism is not enough. Bloody and heroic sacrifices are not enough. The capacity to endure will not of itself alone win victory. The aggressive spirit only can triumph. We must cultivate intelligent, skillful enterprise. We must aim at delivering blows as well as taking them. During the past few weeks, this aggressive spirit has manifested itself in many ways, but particularly in the blows struck by Britain at the heart of Germany and by the heavy damage inflicted by America on the Japanese fleet. Let us then newly resolve to make up its battle than before. Let us newly pledge ourselves to our allies, be free in self-criticism and sparing in our criticism of others. Let us, by so doing, secure a united and coordinated effort to achieve victory. Our cause is to vindicate the dignity of man, the freedom of conscience, and to remove injustices and inequalities that blot the social system of our country. The so-called new order which our enemies are seeking to impose on us through a holocaust of lives is as old as Nineveh and Tyre, and as cruel as the worst tyrannies of primitive barbarism. Their new order aims at the establishment of a master race and the enslavement of the world. And let it be remembered by our Japanese enemy that if Germany wins, he will permit of no other master nation but herself. No such order will be imposed on the world if we resolve to prevent it. And that concludes the news from Chungking for this evening.
This is the Broadcasting Corporation of Japan in Radio Tokyo on the combined overseas 5th and 6th transmission. Radio Tokyo is operating in the 19, 25, and 31 meter band. It is approximately 9 p.m. Tokyo time, or 12 hours Greenwich Meridian time. And here is the night edition of the news from Tokyo. The United States Navy has lost two more warships in the recent Battle of Midway Island. The Imperial Headquarters announced in its communique issued at 4:30 o'clock this afternoon. It It has been confirmed that the Japanese Navy has sunk in the Midway battle one American heavy cruiser of the San Francisco class and an American submarine, in addition to the aircraft carriers of the Enterprise and the Hornet type, the communique declared, adding that approximately 150 American planes, instead of some 120 as previously announced, were definitely shot down by the Japanese naval forces. The 9,950-ton American A-class cruiser San Francisco was completed in 1934. It developed a speed of 33 knots, armed with 9 8-inch guns, 8 5-inch anti-aircraft guns, 2 catapults, and other smaller arms. The cruiser carries 4 airplanes and a crew of 594. The Indianapolis, Astoria, New Orleans, Minneapolis, and Tuscaloosa are the sister ships of the San Francisco. The Japanese occupation of several strategic points in the Aleutian has now come to be viewed in a serious light by the enemy. A Washington dispatch reveals that the United States Navy Department on Saturday announced that Japanese troops had landed in Attu Island in the Aleutian. Meanwhile, the United States, the same day, stated, "The Japanese landing in the Aleutian is extremely significant inasmuch it is the enemy's first landing in the Western Hemisphere." This statement of the United Press is interesting in the light of the fact that the United States military authorities are frantically propagating that the Japanese landing in the Aleutian has no military significance. Madrid, the Washington correspondent of the influential Spanish daily, Ya, quoting an article contributed to the New York Times dated June the 9th, pointed out the discrepancy in the claims advanced by the official United States naval communiques in the recent sea battle off Midway. The contributor contended that the Japanese are not as badly damaged as claimed by the communique, nor is it by any means wiped out. The article assailed the habitual claims of outstanding victories. The contributor added that the facts of the issue will be made known in the future. Lisbon. Port Darwin has been bombed by the Japanese. Japanese bomber formations carried out a devastating air raid upon Port Darwin Saturday. Crushing blow was inflicted on port facilities and military objectives at Port Darwin, according to a Melbourne dispatch. Lisbon. Women and children of Sydney were advised by the Australian government to withdraw from Sydney, report from Sydney revealed. Changjiao, or Guangxing, the center of Chinese military operations in the Third War Zone, which the Chongqing forces boasted of as the strongest and largest platoon of the enemy, has fallen in the face of the lightning operations of Japanese army units. After the fall of Chuchao, the enemy forces attempted the last resistance, establishing their position in a triangular area connecting Yushang, Jiangshang, and Shangshang. But when Shangshang and Yushang fell into Japanese hands as a result of the surprise attack effected by a Japanese unit, the destiny of Shangjiao was already decided. Despite the large-scale resistance offered by the enemy in the defense of Shangjiao, its citadel has easily crumbled before the fierce onslaught of the Japanese. From the war front in South China, detailed account of the crushing of the main forces of the American Volunteer Air Corps over Kui Lin on June the 12th has been disclosed in delayed field dispatch. Early in the same month, journalists Augusto Iglesias and 5 others from Chile visited Japan in August last year and have prolonged their stay in Japan since the outbreak of the Greater East Asia War. But prior to their return to Chile in the very near future, these pressmen have called on the Japanese premier on Sunday afternoon and have exchanged the following view. Premier Tojo expresses regret that the Chilean journalists were obliged to stay in Japan with the outbreak of war, and also expressed respect for the valuable work which they have rendered in reporting to Chile on the true life of Japan. Premier Tojo further stressed the point that he sincerely hopes that Chile will not be involved in the current war, which can be prevented by collaboration of the two countries. He also called attention to the fact that the fundamental element of the Japanese victory rests on the spiritual fighting power. The Premier requested the journalists to contribute their part in giving the true facts of Japan to the people of Chile when they are back in their own country. The Chilean party thanked the Premier for the hospitality which they have received in Japan. In reply to the question of how long this war will last, Premier Tojo said that he's resolved to keep on fighting for another 100 years, but his sincere hope is to crush the Anglo-American camp in the shortest possible time to bring the peace to an end. Commenting on the recently concluded treaties among Britain, the Soviet Union, and the United States regarding the creation of a second front in Europe, political observers here state that the attitude of these countries must be a great blow to the Chongqing regime, both strategically and spiritually, especially at present when the Japanese army is staging fierce attacks throughout the Chinese front, crushing the Chiang Kai-shek army. They point out, from the first, British and American aid to the Chongqing regime has never been aimed at the welfare and happiness of the Chinese people. The whole idea was to make the Chongqing regime the stalking horse of Britain and the United States in East Asia. No sooner had they noticed that the utilization value of the Chongqing regime has become naught on account of the rapid tempo of the Greater East Asia War, then they made a bold departure to approach the Soviet Union, and as far as Britain and the United States are concerned, this is a natural course for them to take, this Churchill declared. It added, even granting that the Britain and the United States have the will to support strongly the Chongqing regime, the objective circumstances in East Asia would not permit it. Both Britain and the United States have now lost confidence even in their ability to defend Australia and India, let alone to talk of aiding Chongqing. This cannot be altered because the realities are beyond the reach of intrigue and malpropaganda, they added. Dr. H. Kung, Vice Chairman of the Chongqing Executive Yuan, in an address on the occasion of the United Nations Flag Day on Sunday, pointedly appealed to the United States that no one nation among the United Nations should be regarded as more important than the other members of the group. The Chongqing leader, implying that there is a tendency to disregard the Chinese war front as of secondary importance, declared that no one's battle line should be given greater importance than the other. Neutral observers interpreted this address by Dr. Kung as an indirect reminder to the Anglo-American leaders that the Chongqing regime should be given equal consideration as one of the important cogs in the Allied war machine. Bangkok. With the slogans of India for the Indians and down with British imperialism, an Indian independence rally sponsored by the Indian Independence League took place in Bangkok Monday morning, attended by Messrs. Raj Bihari Bose, A. M. Sahai, Ambassador Tsubogami, German and Italian ministers, and others. The rally was open with all the attendants offering silent prayers to the souls of those Indians who had given their precious lives for the cause of the Indian independence. Following this, representative of Thai, Premier Thibung Songkram, and Mr. Daha, Bangkok manager of the Independence League, delivered their addresses. Next, Mr. Buhari Booth, Tokyo delegate, took the floor and expressed his firm determination to win the independence, saying, "Success will be crowned only upon those who boldly fight through." Japanese Ambassador Tsubogami sincerely wished the success of the movement, and the German and Italian ministers also promised to give wholehearted support to the independence movement, which will help establish a new world order. Thus, the historical Indian independence rally was brought to a successful close. Bangkok, Raj Buhari Bose, Indian independence leader, made a speech at the general meeting of Indian Independence Federation held here on Monday, and the substance of his speech is as follows. Our resistance against the British imperialism commenced as early as 1859, and when the European War broke out in 1939, Britain took a soothing and inviting attitude towards India to secure help once again. At this juncture, the leaders of our Indian people flatly resisted all British pressure, and we all pay our profound respects to our Mahatma Gandhi for his heroic efforts in keeping India out of the war. With the outbreak of the Greater East Asia War, crack Japanese forces smashed the British imperialism in East Asia on land, sea, and air. I can assure you that there was not a single Indian patriot who has not uttered a cry of joy. The fate of true Indian liberty can be only realized by the Japanese challenge against the British imperialism. Fellow patriots, let us rise firmly, hand in hand, and fight for the cause of Mahatma Gandhi, which he has been fighting for the last 20 years. Bangkok. At the Indian Independence Rally held in Bangkok Monday, Thai Premier Thibaut Thongram conveyed his message through his representative to the following effect. It is for the purpose of bringing freedom and prosperity to India, freeing her from the long-drawn British tyranny, that this independence rally took place today. Japan has certainly taken an initiative in emancipating East Asiatic people. Therefore, all the Asiatic people should wholeheartedly cooperate with Japan to achieve this important task. I sincerely hope that this conference will end in success for India, or rather, for the liberty and happiness of all the Asiatic people. The Japanese ambassador in Bangkok, Mr. Teiji Tsubogami, in his congressional address, stated as follows. As a member of the East Asiatic race, the Japanese people have long awaited the day when India for the Indians being established. Now the opportunity has come, and it is a matter for congratulation that the movement for Indian independence has been started. At this opportunity, I want to specially emphasize that Japan, Germany, and Italy are maintaining close cooperation toward the Indian problem. The three nations have no sinister designs on India. India is now facing a heaven-sent opportunity. If India does not grasp this opportunity, she will perhaps lose forever the opportunity for her independence. Expressing his felicitations on the occasion, German Minister Wendler said the three nations, Japan, Germany, and Italy, are true friends of India inasmuch as they do not have any sinister designs on India. Speaking also at the meeting, Italian Minister Scola stated that Italy, together with Japan and Germany, sincerely wishes the success of the rally. Bangkok. In a telegraphic message of congratulations sent to the general meeting of the India Independence League held in Bangkok Monday, Premier General Hideki Tojo recognized the function as representing the public opinion of the Indian residents in East Asia and further pledged himself that he is ready to support this movement. Expressing his sincere desire for the establishment of India for the Indians, Premier Tojo pointed out that the imperial government is firmly determined to crush Anglo-American forces in India so long as they remain on Indian soil. The Japanese premier also made clear the point that there is only one alternative for saving India out of the ravages of the current war, namely, Britain shall cast away her ambitious designs in India, or India herself will act to sever her relations with the British Empire. Foreign Minister Shigeru Togo also wired a congratulatory message to the meeting in Bangkok, revealing his earnest desire that the leaders of India will unite themselves to destroy British imperialism and to bring about the realization of India for the Indians through the unity of public opinion in India, as well as close cooperation between Japan, Germany, and Italy. Bangkok. Subhash Chandra Bose was actively engaged in the Indian independence movement in Germany, sent a message to the Indian Independence Rally, which took place in Bangkok Monday. His message can be summed up as follows. For us Indian independence leaders, it is absolutely necessary to take up arms and end for the cause of the Indian independence. I firmly believe that during this war, India will surely win liberty. India's freedom means the wiping out of the Anglo-American imperialism, and it is, at the same time, the objective of the invincible Japanese army. Now the time has come for the Indians to rise in one body with an intrepid spirit.